We're back. The Passport Play Podcast. It's been a little while. Too long, in fact, since we last did this. But I'm excited to be back. Hopefully we have a string of good guests coming up. And to start, I reached out to an old friend of mine to help get things rolling again.
I'm with one of my oldest friends. I think you're not one of my oldest friends age-wise. I have older friends than you.
I hope not, yeah.
But we go back a long way. It's Captain Corey Gamble, who I've known since our days as undergrads at Colby College.
1998.
Go Mules.
Rock 'em.
And I want to talk a lot about your time and experience as a fishing boat captain on the island in Nantucket. But before we get into that, I feel it is playoff season. You care about NHL hockey.
Yeah.
I do not.
Yeah. You should, though.
You're a New York Ranger fan.
Yeah.
I am not.
You should be.
So we're taping this on a Tuesday afternoon.
Yep, 7 o'clock tonight.
Rangers are playing the Canadiens.
Yep.
Game 4, and they're down 2-1.
Yep.
Honest assessment, do the Rangers come back and beat the Montreal Canadiens?
They can come back and beat them. I'm not going to say they will. My hope is they make it a great 7-game series, and it's just if they can find their scoring, and they got to get bodies in front of the net, and they got to make Carey Price work. That's it. It's that simple. Like, and they've got to play with the energy they played in game one. Like, that game one energy was awesome. It was awesome. And game two was good energy, but unfortunately it was a tough ending. And then game three, there was no energy. They got to come and play with energy. If they do, they can limit the top guys for the Canadiens, and they can get pucks on net. It's that simple. Play with energy.
You know? I try to get into hockey every time this time every year.
Yeah.
Playoff hockey. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't feel like you need to watch the sport a lot prior to the playoffs to have a general sense of where we're headed. So last night I was toggling back and forth between the Leafs Capitals game.
Yeah.
And I know the Toronto Maple Leafs are kind of emerging as a spring story because they haven't been in the playoffs in a few years, haven't been very good, and the Capitals have been good, but they always seem to be snake bit when it comes to the playoffs.
Yep.
So now the Leafs are kind of the young team, the hungry team, and they're turning the tables on the Caps and their stars. And the other game last night was the Nashville Predators and the Chicago Blackhawks.
Yep.
And I know the Blackhawks well because they've been winning for years, and they were up 2-0 last night. And, you know, it's the middle of the second period, and it's 2-0 Chicago, and the game's in Nashville. I just didn't figure the Predators were going to come back, and so went to bed. First thing, woke up this morning, and I don't know what happened, but the Predators came back 3-2, so it must have been an exciting game.
So this is where why I think I top out as a high school athlete, personally, is you get it. It's so easy to get defeatist attitude. You're down 2-0, and the play's going against you, and you feel like you're going uphill. That's hard. Like, and that, you know, that's probably why I stopped watching the Patriots play in the Super Bowl when they were down by 25 points. I get a little bit of a defeatist attitude, but that's what separates these guys. These guys just keep playing, and you hope playoff hockey. You play until the very you have the hope and the belief that you can do it until the last whistle.
You have somewhat a unique perspective on a lot of these hockey players because, I mean, your experience is unique. You taught and coached a handful of guys who are now NHL players when you were working at Avon Old Farms. And I wonder what that experience has taught you about kind of what it takes to be an athlete at the highest level of their sport. Like, you know, what separates the pros from the guys who are just a cut above? Is it all work ethic? Is it all talent? Is it a combination of the two? Is it luck, like everything else in life?
Yeah, so that to me is an excellent question that not enough people ask, because I think too many people focus on the, you know, if you work hard enough, you'll get there. And I love that. You got to work hard. But I think it's mostly talent, but I think it's talent with work. But the thing you cannot leave out of this is a competitive nature to yourself. And, you know, the I firmly believe that those who ultimately succeed in athletics want to be on the ice, the court, the field, competing. They want to be. To a point where it's not just, you know, we talk about specialists and people playing just one sport and when do they start. I think the best athletes don't specialize until college. They just don't. Because if you have a choice, if you're a hockey player, I can spend the fall working out or I can spend the fall playing soccer or football. What does an athlete want to do? What does somebody who's at the top of their physical ability want to do? Prepare or do they want to play? They want to play. Now, there's a point where you have to maybe do it, and I think 18, 19 is the right time. Some people say earlier. So the answer to that question is I think you got to obviously have the natural talent, the ability to work and use your natural talents. But if you don't have the competitive spirit, no, you're not going to get there, and I firmly believe that.
So do you watch – when you watch a guy like Jonathan Quick, the goalie for the Kings – I know the Kings aren't in the playoffs, but yeah. Quick is obviously one of those kids who you – Did you teach and coach or just advise?
So Quick was the one that I advised his senior year. I just had a relationship with him I had a relationship with a bunch of those kids. His dorm room was right next to mine. Quick was a competitor. Quick was, you know, he's a guy who was completely talented as an athlete. He was a guy who loved to compete and loved being around the guys. And he worked hard. You know, he did a lot of stuff people didn't see. And then he made some smart choices. You know, he made sure he was on the ice surface playing, you know, where there's guys who choose to go to schools where they didn't. I mean, he's a guy who chose to go to UMass Amherst because he could play. Other guys, Cam Atkinson and Nick Bonino, are two guys who are facing off against each other right now in a playoff series. And both are, you know, Cam Atkinson's, you know, had two goals the other night. Nick Bonino took a puck to the face. These are two guys who are played lacrosse and played hockey and played a little soccer at Avon. And these are kids who just wanted to compete. And so that's what the top guys do. They don't want to prepare. They want to play.
All right, let's switch. Let's go from talking about the NHL playoffs and what makes professional athletes today to the reason I had you on the podcast today, which is that for as long as I've known you, which we've established is a long time, you have been involved in fishing. And so not just involved in fishing, you have made it the centerpiece now of your professional life. And I've always been amazed at your ability to take a passion and turn it into a profession. And I think so many people are always searching for that one thing in their life that they love, that they have a chance to then make their work. And it, by all accounts, you've been able to do that. So we got to start somewhat near the beginning and tell us a little bit about how you first started fishing on Nantucket.
I first started as a boy. I was taken out at 6-7 years old by my father. My family used to vacation out there for a couple weeks every summer. And I was taken out by my father, my brothers, and then family friends out beach fishing. And it was that simple. And I loved it. And I'd go out and we'd go on cloudy days, we'd go on pretty days, we'd go on every day. And I loved catching fish. And it evolved from that to learning how to fly fish. You know, I'm the youngest of five kids. Oldest brother's 11 years my senior. He and my other brother, Chan, both taught my twin brother, Cameron, and I how to fly fish. And I remember it took us, I don't know about Cameron, it took me 3 years with a fly rod to catch my first fish. You know, and that's in the streams of Vermont. But it didn't stop me from trying. And we had a pond behind our house, and we'd go out and, you know, I'd use a spinning rod, and I'd catch little sunnies all the time. So I just loved fishing. But I always wanted to emulate my older brothers. And so kind of when I turned 17, 18, I'd done a ton of pond fishing. I'd now done a ton of fly fishing and gotten pretty good at it. So I'd done a lot of freshwater fishing. And all my saltwater fishing had been following others. And I was looking for something different to do. And so I called this guy, Captain Mark, on Nantucket, just graduating high school. And I said, hey, I want to work on a fishing boat. Do you need somebody? And it turns out that Mark kind of needed somebody, but he's just the kind of guy who's willing to give anybody a chance, especially somebody he knows. So he gave me a job working for him summer of 1998, and I went out there. I lived on the boat. It was a 34-foot boat. Lived on the boat, worked for Mark 7 days a week. Some days I was fishing, some days I was cleaning fish, some days I was filming other people catch fish. I was doing everything for him, but I put myself in the industry. But I really was probably because I was following my older brother's footsteps. That's kind of what got me into it at first.
That first summer when you kind of immersed yourself in that life on the island, was there ever a point where you started to wonder, you know, what am I getting myself into here? Or was the whole summer something more reaffirming, something that kind of really gave you guidance as to what you wanted to do next? Because I'm sure somebody in your position was asked to do a little bit of everything. And in doing so, you not just learn all the ins and outs of the job or what it takes to eventually be a fishing boat captain, but you also learn how demanding and how difficult that job is. So did you leave that summer even more emboldened to make that more centerpiece of your life? Or were there more, I guess, red flags that made you question perhaps your decision?
No, I was reaffirmed, and very much so. And it's at that point that, and you know this, going to Colby College, a lot of our peers start thinking about internships in New York City and in Boston and what else you should be doing to set yourself up for life. And I said, nope, this is it for me for the next 4 summers. This is what I'm going to do through college. And I did that for a number of different reasons. One, I was making good money, you know, which is, you know, that's a piece of it, but it certainly wasn't the driving piece. But before college, and this is something you don't know as much about me, I was shy. I was not somebody who could talk to people. And then there's a joke about me that if you put if you put me in an empty stool in the room, that's going to be a heck of a conversation. You know, it's like, that's all because of fishing on Nantucket. I learned to make money, you have to talk to people. And in talking to people, I learned I like talking to people. And there's a lot to learn by asking questions. So it was definitely reaffirmed simply because not only did I find success financially, did I find reward in my day-to-day, I enjoyed what I was doing, but I learned something about myself and what drives me. I enjoy being around people and learning from people. So I knew that I was going to get a better education spending my 4 summers of college there than I was going to be everywhere else.
You talk about the financial reward, and that's certainly something that attracted you eventually to wanting to fish more and more. But I'm sure at first, I mean, you're working incredibly long hours. You're still making a decent wage. There must have been more about the job itself that appealed to you early on than just perhaps the potential money that you could make.
Oh.
Because in order to get you back to something that is so demanding, that is something that is so tiring, that is something so entrepreneurial, there's got to be something more rewarding than just the money. So what is it about the actual fishing, the actual captaining a charter boat that you early on recognized as something, I want to do this and I'm good at doing this?
So let me just, I'll give you the evolution of my life as a fishing boat from mate to captain to business owner in a second. But yeah, the money was icing on the cake for sure. You work 7 days a week, and I say 7 days a week. That's not like, oh, you know, 2 hours on this day. You're working 7 days a week. You're up at 6 a.m. The boat's done being cleaned by 7, 8. That was then. Now I'm up at 3:34 a.m. Now that I own the business and everything else, so the money is great. But anybody who's ever worked 7 days a week for more than, you know, a couple months can tell you there's no much money worth it if you don't love it. And it's that simple. It really is. There's got to be something else that wakes you up in the morning. And I can tell you, there's not a single dollar that wakes me up in the morning. You know, what wakes me up in the morning is who I'm going to be fishing with, what I'm going to see on the water, and the experiences that I'm going to have. I mean, I think about it now. My wife and I talk about, you know, every morning I want to start with an adventure in my day. And that's what it is when I'm fishing, is I want to start with an adventure. And so when I talk about that first summer, I was looking at it as for the next 4 years. And the most rewarding thing, frankly, was less the fishing in those first couple of years, but me figuring out something about myself, that I wanted to live a life around people and moving my body. I didn't want to live a life behind a desk. And that was really, really valuable to me. And that was arguably the biggest lesson. But within that, I also learned that I want my body moving. I love being on the water. I love being on boats. And all of a sudden, it's not just me catching fish that's the drive. It's me helping and teaching people how to catch fish. It's me watching their reaction when they're doing something. And that's ultimately what got me, was all those pieces coming together.
I think people who don't understand the inner workings of your job, to those people, it sounds like a really, really glamorous thing. You know, you're Captain Corey Gamble. You're a fishing boat captain on the island of Nantucket. Every bit of that sounds like you are just leading this life of glamour that, you know, who wouldn't want to choose this as a profession? You've got it made in the sense that how difficult can it really be? And you started to allude to, you know, what your daily routine is like now as a fishing boat captain. As much detail as you can share about that would kind of pull back the curtain for people so they better understand that, okay, there is a lot of hard work that goes into the glamour of being a fishing boat captain.
Yeah. So you're just to talk about the day. So, you know, what I do now is different what I did then. So I've moved into, I went from working on somebody else's boat to running somebody else's boat. And now I not only run my own boat, but I've got multiple boats that I manage as well. And so it's moved from mate to captain to business owner and captain. And so every day, not only are your days long, but you're wearing multiple hats. You're managing people, you're managing clients, you're managing customers. But I'm up on a daily basis between 3 and probably 5:30 a.m. And that all depends on the tide. You know, in June, the sun rises about 4:40. And so I can be on the water as early as 4 a.m. And that's once a week, twice a week, I'm on the water like that. And I'm doing 2 to 3 trips a day. And 2 to 3, each trip is 4+ hours. So you're getting to the boat early before the people are. You are putting ice on there. You're putting the rods together. You're making sure all your equipment works. You know, you sometimes deal with stress. You get down there and something's not working. You got to fix that before the people get down there. When they get down there, you got to have a smile on your face. Meanwhile, the first thing you do when you get to the dock is you listen and you close your eyes and you say, what's the wind doing right now? Blowing 5 to 10? Awesome. Blowing 15 to 20? It's going to be a hard day. You're going to get beat up. What's the weather? Is it going to rain today? You know, and then you're on the water from 4 a.m., 5 a.m. until often 5, 6 p.m., at which point the boat comes home. It's got to get cleaned. Fuel's got to get put in it. At that point, you got to call the customers for the next day. You got to call your captains from the day and see how the day went. And so you, now the business part of your day goes. And that's all the while. Those 12 hours you just spent on the water that day, on a perfect day, you're getting fried by the sun. That's hard. You know, people don't think so. You're dealing with different clients, different personalities. On a tough day, you're getting beat by water, and you're getting beat by rain and wind. You're having to think through elements. And oh, by the way, there's a stress attached to it. People are paying you a lot of money to catch them a fish. And it's not like you just go out to a fish tank and grab one. You have to work very, very hard to make sure people get the experience they want. And it's important to remember that most of the clients who I fish with, this is what they look forward to. And so there's a stress attached to making sure they get what they want. And all the while, you got to be smiling. So you got long days. You got stress just like every other job. You've got worries just like every other job. And, oh, at the end of the day, you got to come back and manage people. And that's hard. And then you know what? You don't get the next day to recoup. You got to do that 7 days a week, you know, over a 90-day season.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the specific nature of your clients. And, you know, if being part of essentially the service industry on an island like Nantucket ever gets you down, because, I mean, you are dealing with some of the wealthiest people in the country, perhaps the world. And you are expected to deliver on the promise of, I mean, you're not promising, you know, the biggest fish in the sea, but there's a certain experience that you are expected to deliver. And you're dealing with people who want results. That's what they get for a living. That's how many have amassed their fortune. There've got to be times during the summer where you just shake your head and you say, boy, I don't want to have to listen to this person speak this way. I don't want to have to take this person out further to find fish that they think are over there when I know they're not. It's got to bother you every once in a while.
Yeah, it's, yes. I mean, I'll tell you where I'm very lucky is 20 years into the business now, and I've built the business slowly over time. It kind of in the last 3-4 years, it did hockey stick up a little bit, but I've built a business around clients who trust me and who I trust. And much of my new client base is referrals from old clients. And so there's connection points. So once you establish a relationship, it does ease certainly the stress a bit. And I will say what begins to the early season, you're usually around people you know. As it sort of gets into sort of later July and early August, when not a lot of people coming on island, a lot of things are moving real busy. There are times when you exhaustion sets in and you forget that your job out here is to make their experience great, and that every person's bringing a unique attitude for a unique reason. And I do find myself needing to reset. And usually when I need that, I sit down with a couple other captains, and rather than bitch and moan, I say to them, guys, let's just talk about what makes this job so awesome. And sometimes we just need that snap, that reminder of we have something great here. Because like every other job, the days are long, but we all have chosen this because we love it. And this kind of gets at a question you asked earlier. There's a lot of people who start in doing this and stop doing this because it's too hard, you know? And there's a lot of mates who don't make it past half a season. It's too hard. It's too much work. You know, every successful working captain on Nantucket I know well because there hasn't been a new working captain on Nantucket in 4 years. And that's because it's hard to come in and few people want to stay if it doesn't work for them. So it's one of those that we all have to remind each other why we're in this. But it does. You get moments and you get clients that push you to the edge. Sometimes you also need to stand your ground. There are clients who I've stood up to and they end up never fishing with you again, and that's okay. You know, sometimes you do have to hold your ground a little bit. But
let's talk specifically about the island of Nantucket and how your line of work might not be possible, or at least your success might not be possible in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. How fortunate do you think you are to be located on Nantucket and not somewhere else, as far as it being the perhaps the perfect storm for the types of factors that ultimately make you successful? You know, plenty of fish, plenty of clients, beautiful location. Those things are all kind of create this special circumstance for making what you do
absolutely true. And it's, you know, the other thing that you didn't mention that also makes it is I think we're lucky that some people will call it 2 months, some people call it 4 months, some people call it 5 months season. That's a good thing because the Florida guys, I think they burn themselves out without admitting to it because they're doing it 12 months a year, where we can go hard and fast and at the end of the season, we're tired, but it gives us time to recoup going into the winter. But we're incredibly lucky. I'm incredibly lucky. If you look at it, I've got connections to clients through other areas where I've lived in life, through friends I've made, through other clients I've taken out. So we have a plethora of clients, potential clients, who are on island. And when they're on island, they're on vacation. They're out there and they want to give their kids the experience that they remember from when they were kids. They want to do everything that makes them happy, and fishing is one of those things. So we are incredibly lucky. And on top of it, we've got a place that produces fish. If you bring Jack and Charlie up, I can tell you, we'll go catch fish. We will. And, you know, some people might want a specific fish. Well, we might not catch those, but I'm going to catch you a fish that's going to make your kid smile. I can tell you that.
Jack and Charlie are 6-2, so I'm hoping that we wouldn't go very far off the coast.
No, though, I mean, and they're frankly not my target. You know,
can we start in a pond?
And Nantucket's got great pond fishing, too. I don't lead those charters, but I do a lot of that for fun. But it's, you know, I love taking a 6-year-old fishing if they're the right Demeter because they love it. And that's all I want to take. Like I take a lot of diehard fishermen on. I take a lot of guys who fish all over the world, only one of a fly rod in their hand, and are targeting a certain fish. That's cool. I love that. And I love that because those guys love fishing. But I also love taking Jack at 6 years old out because Jack, his smile is just as big as that other guy's. And that's what gets me. It's not the need for me to come home and tweet and Instagram about this fish that was caught on my boat. It's about me bragging how great a time that person had on my boat. That to me is what drives me. And so whether it's a 6 year old or whether it's a 65 year old, as long as they've got the right attitude and we're out trying to accomplish that goal together, it's going to be a good day.
You were talking earlier about how there hasn't been a new fishing boat captain on Nantucket in something like 4 years. Is a little competition in the charter boat world on Nantucket a good thing? Or do you wish you had it all to yourself more than you currently do?
No, the competition's great. Mostly because, and it's easy for me to say this, competition is good because there's enough room for competition. You know, none of the established guys are sitting home on an August day wondering where their next trip is. You know, if that was the case, we'd be having some trouble. But there's enough business for mostly established. Competition's also good because we're friends. You know, I can tell you that there's two distinct group of fishing boat captains on that island. Half the guys work downtown in Nantucket Harbor proper on what's called Strait Wharf, and they do a different type of fishing. They're more trolling. They're more sort of serving the clients who are just there to kind of fish for a day, where there's a group of us in Matic at the West End are more sort of casting and what I would call more sort of established fishermen. I'm lucky. I used to work with the downtown guys. I now work in Matic. I call most of those guys downtown my friends and the Matic guys my friends. If something happens to me on the water, I've got guys out there who will help me and I'll help them. And that's what makes competition good. You got friends. If I have a tough day fishing, I can call up a lot of people and say, hey, what'd you do today? And my hope is that they did better than I did and I can learn something from what they went through or vice versa. So I'd say right now there's a healthy amount of competition. But there are a few people who don't get along as well. I'd say I'm lucky I'm in a spot where I try and respect everybody else and learn from everybody else.
You mentioned if you get in a spot of trouble out on the water, are there inherent perils with being a fishing boat captain? I mean, is it kind of, you know, clients need to be aware that there are potential issues that can and do arise on the water? I mean, are we talking about it being a kind of a dangerous recreation here? What types of things will typically pop up that will kind of raise a red flag as, well, this is somewhat out of the ordinary for what we're doing?
Well, you can
make... Storm comes up?
Yeah, exactly. So the things that happen is rough seas, things that can go wrong, rough seas, thunderstorms can move in, your boat can break down. I mean, this is it's a piece of equipment. You know, you can be 3 miles offshore, you can be 50 miles offshore, and a motor can stop working for any number of reasons. But I'd say weather and equipment are your two big ones. And if it's a good day, people can come help you. You know, if it's not a good day, it's hard for them. Some of it's within your control, some of it's out of your control. But it's also, you got to pick your spots too. It's... you know, usually it's wind will indicate sort of how rough it is out there. Obviously, thunder and lightning, you don't want to go out in that. But, you know, if there's a 20% chance at a thunder and lightning storm in 3 hours, do you cancel the trip? And that's a really big question, because if you just cancel every trip that might have bad weather, you don't have a sustainable business. You know, sometimes you have to go out and then you have to try and avoid the weather when you're out there. And that's something that you have to navigate appropriately. You know, some of the clients will say, you know, it's raining a little bit today. I don't think it's the right day for us to go fishing. That's hard because somebody else would have gone fishing. So you have to balance everything. But safety has to be your number one concern, for sure.
I have an irrational fear of running out of gas. And it all stems from this one experience on the St. Lawrence River when I was probably 5-6 years old, and we had our Boston Whaler out, and we hadn't gone more than, I would say, maybe just a quarter mile, and the boat broke down, and I think I was on the boat with third cousin, you know, a couple of my cousins, and no more gas. And at that point, I absolutely lost it. You know, river of tears, beyond consolable. There was nothing that was going to make me feel better other than having gas. And as it turned out, we had driven upriver, so the flow of the river took us nice and safely back to the dock within about 10 minutes. But ever since then, I have had an irrational fear of running out of gas, whether it be on a boat or in a car. So if you ever have the fortune of taking me out fishing, I would hope you'd have enough gas.
Yeah, so it's interesting you bring that up. I would say I've got the same thing, and I've run out of fuel before on charters, one charter. And that was because a fuel tank wasn't reading right. But I've also gone out on charters with less fuel than I'd like and adjust the fishing trip you want to go on. And most of my peers have gone out and without enough fuel, or they had enough fuel and there was something happened to the fuel system. So that's a real, and it's the same thing. It's like if you ask any charter boat captain on Nantucket if they've run aground at some point, they all have. You know, it's a question of whether they'll admit it or not.
Yeah.
So there's like, there's all these things out there, you know. You know, have you ever been hooked before? Have you ever gotten a hook in you? Yeah. Have you ever had a client get a hook in? Yes. There's all these things that are real that can happen out there. And you have to manage in that situation. You know, and the fuel's one that's like, it's so silly, but it's, that to me is an irrational fear. But it very well could be that I'm taking a trip at 10 in the morning. I come back to the dock at 2 and the people are waiting right there. So I put them on the boat and then I come back and at 6, I'm doing an evening cruise from 6 to 8:30, but I can't because the fuel dock's closed now. And then I've got a 5 a.m. in the morning. You're like, wait a second. I should have fueled up at 10 a.m. this morning. So you have to be thinking ahead a lot about fuel. And that's why I always keep it at least a half a tank, because I don't like that feeling. Although it's way more expensive to run a boat at half a tank than it is at a quarter tank. More weight.
I follow your logic completely. And it's one of my guiding principles anytime I'm on the road is, you know, a quarter tank of gas is just not enough. You need to get a little bit more in order to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Boats would even make that fear even worse for me.
Yeah. I had one story last summer where I was out with arguably one of my most loyal clients, great, great guy. He had brought a guy on the water that he wanted to impress. It was a 5 a.m. trip. And I was leaving Hither Creek, and this guy that he wanted to impress was just up for 24 hours. And I don't think I was on the boat the day before, but maybe I was. But no matter what, we went out with 2 bars of fuel. Now a boat typically has 10 bars, you know, that's a gauge. And so 2 bars is 20% of max capacity. So that's about 36, 38 gallons is what I had on the boat. And we wanted to go to a spot that was 10 miles offshore. The whole thing was a gamble. And I can tell you, we went out there and it was one of the worst 5 hours I've ever had. And we made it back. I didn't go as far as I wanted to go. I don't think we had as good a trip as it could have been. We still had a fine trip, but those were 5 hours of agony. And I made it work. And I think that's, if you talk to any successful captain, and this is one of the things that one of my business partners and I talk about a lot, is a good fishing boat captain is able to figure it out. You know, you don't dwell on what was. You figure out the situation and you make the most of it, you know.
Making the most of it. One of the things that we've talked about recently is how weather and climate is increasingly hard to predict. You know, talking about storms coming up, talking about just how weather patterns and seasonal patterns are shifting and the kind of impact that has on your environment. And certainly the water temperature and the types of fish that are going to frequent around Nantucket. Tell us a little bit about how that has made your job more difficult and how that has you thinking about what the future looks like for your line of work.
Yeah, so it's, you know, this is something we're always paying attention to, is are we catching as many fish this summer as we caught last summer? What's the reason why or why not? And sometimes it's weather driven, but you know, what we've been noticing a lot recently is it's bait driven. And we are in a spot right now where we are, a bunch of us as captains are incredibly worried about the bait situation. You know, we're worried some of our primary prey bait is, you know, silver sides, which are healthy, which is good, but those are good for some fish. Squid, which are good for striped bass, those are getting overfished in a major, major way. Herring, which is getting overfished in a major, major way. And it's just something that we're having to deal with. I mean, there's large politics in our world because we're having to go to the Mid-Atlantic fisheries. We're having to go to the Massachusetts state legislature and say, hey, all this commercial fishing that you're letting happening, it's hurting your recreational fishing. And we're having to argue with them that the recreational impact on an economy is way greater than the commercial. But we don't have lobbyists. They've got lobbyists. And so there's a world that we're learning about as fishermen about how to protect ourselves right now that isn't really, really interesting, because we are seeing our bait get demolished by commercial factors, and we need to learn how to stand up and protect ourselves. And luckily we're starting to do it, and we've got support to do it. The other thing is we're seeing impact from change in water temps and all that's going on with weather, and it's, you know, we are catching some fish, black sea bass, in a rate that we never ever caught 4 or 5 years ago.
Because they're typically warmer weather.
They're moving up from the south. And so guys off the Carolinas are sitting there going, where are these fish? And we're like, we got them, you know, because they're pushing up. And so you see, and, you know, those are, we're seeing effects that weather's having on us, you know, changing ocean temps are having on us. In some ways you can say, well, that's positive. Yeah, there is positive. We are so concerned about a balanced ecosystem, because if that balanced ecosystem doesn't exist, we get hurt. You know, another big one is seals. Seals have been protected for years upon years. You can't do anything to them. You can't kill them. You can't hunt them. You can't do anything. Well, that's when seals were devastated by seal hunters. Now seals have made their way back, and they are taking over the northeast coastline, anywhere around Cape Cod, Nantucket, to a point where fishermen have stopped fishing, because when they catch a fish, a seal will take it from their line. So every time they cast out, if they're catching fishing from the beach, they'll catch it with a $12 lure. A seal takes it. What did they just do? Not only did they not catch the fish, they got frustrated, and what else just happened? They lost 12 bucks. We do that 3-4 times, you're not going to fish anymore. That has severe impact, you know.
Might not be the best business decision, however, for you to start going around Nantucket clubbing baby seals.
No, that's not what we're... But there's a lot of...
The optics of you and your fellow fishing boat captains going around and slugging some cute little seals.
No, but you get people who every year hear of like 4 seals shot off of Monomoy, you know. But the real thing is, what eats seals?
Sharks.
Yes. What is the biggest feared shark in the ocean?
Great whites.
Now you got great whites all around Cape Cod, and now they're around Nantucket. You know, it's like, so let's protect the seals. Well, great. Let's bring in the great whites. So this is what happens, right? And so it's sort of this, you know, we undermanage seals, you know, we let them, you know, free to do anything, not bring in the sharks. And then, because we're protecting the animals there. Okay, great. Then all of a sudden, well, let's protect the prey, you know, let's protect the herring, let's protect the squid, let's protect the menhaden, the alewives, let's protect all this stuff because it's going to help the finfish. No, we want to look out for the commercial guys, you know, the commercial fishermen. And so it's just like, well, what are we protecting here? We're overprotecting one, we're underprotecting another. You know, if we want to harvest from the ocean, we have to do it within balance. We have to do it thinking towards the future.
But those commercial fishermen serve a much larger segment of the population than you, the charter boat fishing captain, correct? I mean, if you're talking about legislating and lobbying, granted, you don't have the capital to make any kind of political challenge to, you know, what you're facing with the commercial fishermen, but you have a very, very small base of clients that you're dealing with, whereas those commercial fishermen are perhaps providing for more people. Therefore, it perhaps is more important to make sure that their needs are serviced.
Well, it depends on how you're looking at it, right? And that's obviously, that's what makes it an argument is, you know, how are they providing for more people? By giving them dinner, right? Well, it all comes back to economics, right? If you limit what they can catch, the supply is going to decrease. When you have a lower supply, what ultimately will happen is prices will shoot up, you know? And what hopefully that does is it forces people to think about alternative ways of raising fish, of selling fish, you know, fish farming. That's how salmon fish farming came about. And that's something I believe in, is we need to look to alternative sources for fish. What happens is people don't realize that the supply is running out until it runs out. And so
then what do you do?
Well, you just don't have those fish anymore. You know, there are some success cases that have happened, striped bass being one of them, where the federal government in 1980 put a moratorium on striped bass. No one could target a striped bass. No one. And fortunately, striped bass had the ability to come back. But that's the federal government taking a absolutely crazy step, just like they did with the seals. And it worked. And it worked because the fish had the wherewithal to produce in mass, and we're able to do it. And that's cool that the federal government stepped in and helped that fish out. Well, that's great. That worked. The work they've done with the swordfish is helping, but you still got cod. Cod's still way overfished, and its stocks are well below 10% of what they should be. So, yeah, you can argue that the commercial guys are feeding people, but at what cost are they feeding people? And that's the cost is to the fishery, and the cost is also to the recreational fishermen.
One of the things that has always amazed me about your specific, you know, view on the fish you catch is that you for the most part catch and release, right?
Yes.
You're not keeping the fish that you catch. You advocate that your clients do the same thing, but ultimately if they want to keep it, they're allowed to keep the fish they catch if they're a certain size. But for the most part, you're catch and release.
Yeah, everything that I'm about is the experience. And that's where I said before, it's whether you're a 65-year-old man catching a certain fish in a fly rod or your son Jack at 6 years old. I want that experience to be awesome. And keeping fish for keeping fish sake doesn't make that experience awesome. That's sort of an old school culture of how what you do when you're fishing. Now, if part of your and Jack's experience is to take the fish home, fillet it, cook it up with Maggie, and have a family experience around this fish, cool. I'm into that. I don't mind that. You guys want to keep 4 fish because you want to take a picture with them all? No, that's not happening because there's no value. Now you're not valuing that fish. So I've got no problem keeping a fish as long as I know you guys are going to eat it. I also know that fish, unless handled properly, aren't really great for more than a day or two. So if you say you're going to dinner tonight, I don't want you keeping that fish because that fish probably isn't going to be very good tomorrow night, you know, unless you take care of it perfectly. You come home, we ice it down, you go right home, you keep it in ice, and you cook it the next night. So yeah, I'm a big advocate of catch and release because I'm about the experience of it all as opposed to the harvest of it.
When they make the movie about your fishing life,
mm-hmm.
Can I play you?
I would love that. You look like George Clooney, so. And I don't look like George Clooney, so. I don't know how that's going to work.
What sort of advice would you give me in order to play Corey Gamble, the fishing boat captain?
Bring a positive energy. Make the trips. Make it fun. You know, and that's one of the things I try and do, and that's what I try and do now that I'm a dad. I try and make the experiences around me fun. And as we talked about earlier, it's a long day. You know, I've got long days, I've got long weeks, I've got a long summer, but I love it, and I do. And you got to make it fun, because no matter how much you love something, it'll drain you unless you find a way to extract energy from it. And for me, that's often putting energy into it.
All right, how about I start by just documenting a day on the water?
Sure. When do you want to come up?
Well, I've been saying I'm going to come up now for 20 years, so yeah. Maybe this is finally the year.
Yeah, we got you up there a year and a half ago. And I will say that you said on the ride home, I will do that again in a heartbeat.
I didn't get out on the water, though. I mean, I'm
Nope, but you got up there in November. Got up to Nantucket. You got up there in November.
I've been to Nantucket a few times, but it's about time that I experienced the water with Captain Corey.
Yeah, it's something that I love. I love getting friends out there, and I love, you know, it's I think we all have one or two, or some of us are lucky enough to have three, four, or five things that we're excellent at. You know, it's, you know, I remember going with my dad to work when I was a kid. I don't know if you ever did that. I mean, your dad being a teacher, and you're amazed by how great your dad is at what they do. I think we're all really amazing at one, two, or three things. We are. We just are. And it's sometimes we're lucky enough to make our money doing it. Sometimes it's just something we do. You know, it's like you look at my wife, and she's an amazing mother. That's one thing. But she's also an amazing artist. And so to watch her do these art, it's just so much fun to watch. And that's... am I a great fisherman? I think I'm a good fisherman, but I'm great at making your experience on the water great. That's where I'm great. And I think that's where you would love it, because you would be watching me in my element. And I think we talked at the very beginning of this conversation about the concept of passion. And, you know, there's so many people in this world right now who say, you know, passion isn't real. Passion isn't something you should pursue. And I think that's a whole bunch of malarkey. It's like, and it's not that passion is something that just makes you smile. When you're doing it, it makes you smile. And get really good at the things that make you smile. And really good is relative. It's not, you know, like if you love basketball, you might not compete with LeBron James, but go be a heck of a basketball coach. You know, find your role within that passion of yours. There's a lot of different ways of doing it. So,
in fairness, there are very few people who can compete with LeBron James.
Agreed.
But you're a hockey guy, not a basketball
guy. Yeah. Understood.
Thanks, Corey. That was a lot of fun. No promises on this summer, but...
this fall?
Maybe this fall.
Let's go beyond the maybe.
Get out on the water.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.